Welcome to the Litigation Finance Podcast. I'm your host, John Freund. This podcast is brought to you by the Litigation Finance Journal, the only dedicated news source to the litigation finance industry. Please visit www.litigationfinancejournal.com. Our guest today is Paul Haskell, co-chair of the corporate department of Richards, Kibbe & Orr. Paul's background in distressed credit investment led to the development of a litigation funding practice at his firm. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So you have a background representing hedge funds and investment banks in secondary distress and high yield investments. So how did you come to develop a litigation funding practice? And what are the corollaries between the two asset classes that would make distressed debt investors interested in litigation funding?
Thanks, John. It is interesting the way we got into this, which is my background is, as you said, representing hedge funds and investment banks. Investing mainly in credit and distressed credit, like bank loans, bankruptcy claims, trade claims, and generally in distressed enterprise. And the way I always see my clients are as really lenders of last resort, because they provide credit in situations when traditional sources of credit are generally not available. And frankly, since the Great Recession, or since about 2010 after that, there really has been less of a need for these lenders of last resort, because frankly, the central banks of major economic countries have been providing cheap credit during that time. So there's a couple of reasons why those clients became interested in litigation finance. One obviously is that they're looking for other things to do. This is an area that provides a high rate of return combined with a high rate of risk, naturally. But also, if you think about it, their expertise is in looking at and analyzing complex and difficult to value court proceedings and other situations, which is in many ways is quite similar to lit finance. As a result of that, so many of my traditional distressed clients started calling us and sort of looking at these situations, you know, as funders, and asked us if we would apply our credit expertise to the area.
So as I'm sure you know, risk is obviously a big issue with litigation funders assessing that risk. You prepare documents and structure deals that try to minimize the risk to litigation funders. So what are some of the key issues you focus on when you're structuring these funding agreements?
Sure. And of course, there's definitely no more than one way to structure these deals. And in a sense, that's what makes the area so interesting and so fun for lawyers and for business people, frankly. Because there is room for creativity in preparing these structures. So, you know, we look at about literally 8 or 9 factors whenever we go into a new transaction. We look at almost always paramount is going to be tax efficiency. Certain investors have certain parameters for their investors, certain types of investments that they can or cannot make. So we have to make sure that we're structuring the deal in the right way. We look at traditional old-time common law principles such as champerty and usury, which is well-known for litigation financiers, to try to structure the deal in such a way as to minimize that risk to the transaction. And where exactly is the litigation? Of course, we look at the merits of the litigation, and I'm not a litigation attorney, but we have litigation partners here who do an excellent job of assessing merits. We look at collection risk, and again, that goes back to our expertise in credit, which is, okay, even if your investee wins the case, are you going to be able to collect? Will the recipients of the award be able to hide the winnings in such a way? What is the timing of the payment stream? How long will it take to collect, even if you have a creditworthy fundee? And ultimately, which we'll talk about in a little bit, legal ethics plays a big part into it, which is what are the obligations of the law firm? What is your relationship with the law firm that's representing the plaintiff? Disclosure risk, right? There's increased risk of, as a funder, being disclosed in the court proceedings. And how do you handle that? How important is that to the client? And then finally, I think in terms of actually structuring the agreement, there's typically a waterfall of payments, a sharing of payments, of proceeds of the litigation, typically shared amongst the plaintiff, of course, the funder, and the law firm. And how those get how that gets structured is often critical to the effectiveness of the transaction.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, these deals are obviously completely bespoke. I understand that in terms of the financials, that they must be. But when it comes to the legal ethics side of funding agreements, things like disclosure, which you touched on, and maintaining attorney-client privilege, exhibiting restraint when it comes to controlling the case, things like that, how standardized are those provisions? Do different funders have different rules or points that they want to stress, or is this a uniform sort of system across the board?
Excellent question. So, you know, you're absolutely right, first of all, that all the agreements look different. Whenever I see funding agreements that are prepared by other firms, they look completely different. But I think there has become increased standardization as far as concern about legal ethics. And, you know, the issues that are relevant to that are going to be how much control, you know, how much control can the funder have over the management of the case? How much control can the funder have over management of the how the law firm conducts its business and interacts with its clients? I think increasingly it's become quite standard that the funders are quite careful about making clear that the documents provide that they do not have control. Another area of legal ethics that's become, I think, more standardized is access to information. So increasingly, funders are much more comfortable saying, look, I'm not going to access confidential, potentially privileged information. I would like you as the law firm or as the plaintiff to keep me apprised of how the case is going. But there really has developed a sort of a hands-off standard in the industry. And, you know, the way that you get comfortable and the way that our clients get comfortable by being able to do that is that they provide, hopefully, in the funding waterfall, motivates all the parties, the other parties, meaning the plaintiff and the law firm, to do their best as aggressively as possible to effectively prosecute the case. And so I will tell you that I think that over the years, it's become more standardized. I think when I first started this practice a few years ago, the documents for the funders were a lot more aggressive about controlling the litigation, controlling settlement, and getting access to privileged information. And I think that's really been tempered over the last couple of years.
So shifting gears a little bit here, what can you tell us about your involvement in terms of funding law firms rather than simply the plaintiffs themselves? Do you broker or structure deals in that space?
So sure. This has been a very interesting area for us. First, to be clear, to make it clear, I'm a corporate lawyer. So I represent clients structuring and preparing the documents for the transaction. So I know that there are many litigators involved in this area. And litigators in firms that have big plaintiff side practices will often introduce their clients to funders and work on those transactions. And, you know, at times my litigation partners do seek funding for their cases, but our firm itself really does mostly work defending financial institutions. So we have fewer opportunities for that type of work. We do have private equity clients that from time to time they do have portfolio companies that have potential claims, or in connection with M&A transactions, there may be a dispute over the transaction itself. So we do see opportunities from time to time, but for the most part, my personal practice is representing investors. The law firm funding itself is especially interesting. These are generally firms and lawyers who are working on contingency for all sorts of different types of cases, and really, you know, need the funding to sort of keep the lights on while a case progresses towards a judgment or a collection.
Yeah, and from the funder's perspective, then how does law firm funding differ from plaintiff funding?
Sure. So in law firm funding, ethics are paramount. Right. So that's the big difference between funding a law firm and funding a plaintiff directly. Law firms, the law firms that we fund, they themselves are different, express different levels of sensitivity to the issue. But from a funder's perspective, we want to ensure that we are, one, not interfering with the attorney-client relationship. We want to make sure that we have little or no control over settlement or decisions in how to pursue and strategic decisions on how to pursue the litigation. Fee sharing has become a really significant issue and a really significant concern. I think most folks are aware of the New York City Bar opinion, which last from last year, which cited that in many cases, or in some cases, a lawyer who receives a fee, sharing for attorney of a payment to a funder contingent on receipt of a legal fees is prohibited. Many lawyers who are being funded are quite sensitive to this. And so as a result of that, some of them have preferred to structure the transaction as a loan because they think that that will be one way to avoid that concern. But otherwise, we try to put in the types of protections against for which the fee sharing prohibition was created, which is to prevent interference with the attorney-client privilege.
So you're the first guest I've had on since the Muddy Waters Burford Capital news broke. So I want to zoom out a bit and ask you a couple questions on that. Given this situation now, and also, of course, you mentioned the NYC bar opinion, which happened last year. How do you feel like these are impacting investor interest in the space? Have you noticed anything? What about even claimants or law firms who are seeking funding? Are they asking you more questions, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so to take it one at a time, so in respect of the New York City bar opinion, yes, I think we have seen firms in New York especially asking a lot more questions. As I said, a lot of these firms that we're funding are smaller, so they may be less sophisticated and less up on the opinion itself. So they ask a lot of questions. We do everything we can to try to get them comfortable, and generally we've been successful. The funding community, my sense, the funding community is not that alarmed. There's been an enormous amount of pushback against the opinion, and there is I think the City Bar has now convened a working group to try to look at the opinion and look at the area. So I don't think there's been ultimately that much negative fallout from the New York City bar opinion. The Muddy Waters case and situation is really quite fascinating, and it'll be interesting to see at the conference that we attend next week about how folks feel about it. I myself am expressing no opinion on the allegations themselves, but I do think it shines a really interesting spotlight on the industry, and especially on valuation. As you can tell, litigation cases are very hard to value. They can often have binary outcomes. So it can often be, I either get zero or I get 4x. So very hard to sort of mark to market or value like a hedge fund would value a traditional equity investment or debt investment, even a distressed debt investment. Another thing is that, and I think this was discussed in Burford's portfolio, is that the value can be very concentrated of your portfolio in just a few cases. And I think to Burford's defense, I think that's the nature of the animal. The fact that you can have extraordinary returns in a few cases and then quite middling returns in many others. And that is just the nature of the animal. The part of the concern is that the fact that Burford and like others is a public company, and so its shares get acquired every day, bought and sold every day, and there's a market. Most of my clients are generally private PE funds or hedge funds, and they have the advantage in that they place these investments generally in more of a private equity type of structure, so that they are valued at cost at the beginning. They are not marked to market, and generally the return to the investor only comes out at the end. So they don't have the same concerns as do companies that are public, like a Burford or like other similar ones. But certainly investors are going to be more concerned and more focused on this area as a whole, and I'm sure they're asking more questions. But it remains to me remains to be seen what type of effect it'll have on the market as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely a lot of renewed questions about whether or not funders are well suited for public markets. There's definitely arguments for and against that. Yeah, so just final question here. Looking ahead now, how big of a monkey wrench do you feel like the Muddy Waters Burford situation is for the industry? Do you see continued growth for the industry over the coming year? Obviously, the industry has been experiencing monumental growth, record growth, obviously, over the past couple of years. Do you see that continuing, or do you think investors might start to shy away from litigation funding?
Of course, I don't know the answer. I can't predict the future, but I don't think that the Muddy Waters situation will otherwise have a material detriment to the growth of the industry. I think the industry is very, very popular. The valuations are good. I can still see it continue to grow. I do think that what I've seen over the last few years is that there is obviously more funders entering the industry, and as a result of that, returns are somewhat tempered. I think maybe they were arguably too high at the very beginning. So I think this is ultimately a good thing for the industry. I frankly, as a distressed debt lawyer, I think the bigger threat to the industry may be that if we do hit another recession or some type of credit event, that there will be other more investment opportunities other than lit funding, and that a lot of the folks who've entered the space, a lot of my clients who've entered the space, will diversify into other areas. That's not to say that they will retreat from lit funding, but they will also there'll be other opportunities to deploy their capital.
Yeah, definitely going to be exciting times ahead. That's for sure. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We appreciate you taking the time and sharing your thoughts on litigation funding.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for hosting.
And if you'd like to learn more about Paul, you can visit his law firm's website, rkollp.com, and search for Paul's name, Paul Haskell. They also have a very interesting article that they published there, 7 Things You Need to Know If You're Investing in Litigation Finance. So it's a great article. You should all check that out. And thanks for listening. We appreciate it. We'll see you next time on the Litigation Finance Podcast.